The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. At this time, with American prestige being shattered around the world with dramatic reversals for American foreign policy, with the ignominy and the shame of the dismemberment, finally, of South Vietnam after we've poured over $170 billion and over 56,000 lives, it's time we wondered about the role of the United States of America in the community of nations. Where are we? What are we? What do we stand for? What do we intend doing in the future? Are we, in practical fact, an empire, as we seem to have tried to become? Ever since World War II, when by the dint of what was called the arsenal of democracy, the unbelievable power and strength of the raw materials and the labor force of the United States plummeted us to a position of unparalleled power and strength to where we literally were number one. But from that time to this, we have not acted like we wanted to be number one, like we were willing to accept all the hazards as well as the benefits of being number one, like we were really willing to go out and try to police the world no matter what it cost in terms of lives or dollars. Instead, we have flinched. We have drawn back. We have listened to past presidents such as Mr. John Kennedy, President John Kennedy, who made the statement that we would bear any burden, that we would accept whatever cost in order to defend and protect our allies and friends abroad. But when it comes right down to the debacle we now see in Vietnam and the Congress divided against the president who was not clearly of the people's choice, we know that those words were just so much ceremony for the inaugural address that they are not necessarily the guiding lights of foreign policy of a great people, that we are not willing really to accept any cost in the defense of foreigners abroad. So we have been, in effect, like an empire, thinking that perhaps if a trouble spot erupts in Indonesia, it is ours. If an earthquake destroys Managua, it is our problem. If a fishing war erupts in Iceland, we are concerned. If the Middle East breaks out into a conflagration, we are very deeply involved. If the communists are about to absorb one other nation in Southeast Asia, it is our fight and our problem. And so, like Atlas shouldering the entirety of the world and trying to hold everything up, the United States looked here and there and thither and yon where every problem had erupted, trying to solve the problem by massive food shipments, or clothing, or the American Red Cross, other aid groups, even private citizens leasing and chartering their aircraft and trying to send emergency shipments abroad to help people even in natural disaster and calamity. Our NATO allies we have kept pumped up with American military aid and direct financial aid. Around the world, the United States has tried to play the part of empire. But we are not an empire. And we do not employ the professional legions, the soldiers, the mercenaries who could enforce upon the world a kind of a Pax Americana along the lines of so-called Pax Romana during the height of the Roman Empire when all of the satellite countries could live under the guarantee of the might of the armies of Rome and could live at a kind of a peace, at least so it was called, Roman peace, Pax Romana. And we have tried to enforce the American brand of peace upon the world. Of democracy, of free enterprise, of the right of a free people to choose their own government for themselves when some of those people didn't even know what that meant, when some of those people wouldn't know how to do that if given the opportunity. And yet we have, in this task, proven equal to the chore when the chips were really down. At least some members of the government and the military were, if the disenchantment and the disaffection of the people grew apace to the point we were literally dismembering ourselves in the late 60s with our unbelievable futility and the total rejection of the war in Vietnam. Now today it's time for a serious reappraisal. Are we going to sink down into a neo-isolationism to the point we will once again be just about as vulnerable, but now given nuclear bombs and more powerful enemies, as we were in 1939, 1940, 1941, when war clouds were again on the horizon, when Europe was already tortured with war, when Britain was going it alone and standing in the gap among all civilized nations, it appeared, with one country after another being gobbled up by Hitler's blitzkrieg attacks. In only a few days, nations such as Belgium, Luxembourg, Norway, Denmark were overrun as the United States stood by. In largely isolationist America, perhaps, and many people speculate, and will we ever really know, perhaps FDR actually did know an attack of some sort might come. People have speculated about that, though there is, I think, no actual documentation to prove it. Maybe in his master design he did understand that the only catalyst to get a largely apathetic America, an isolationist America, plummeted to the position of true strength where he thought it rightfully belonged was through the catalyst of a world war. Maybe he knew, because of the arsenal of democracy, would have the time. Because of the vastness of our oceans, some people have alleged that FDR even speculated about virtually giving up major slices of West Coast real estate to the Japanese attacking armies and withdrawing behind the Mississippi. But I think that's a lot of barroom talk rather than anything which could be thoroughly documented out of any secret letters. Be that as it may, that's the way it worked. Oh, not the occupation, but I mean the attack at Pearl Harbor. The unbelievable debacle that that was, the long, dark struggle then, as one American possession after another was overrun by the Japanese, the Philippines, of course, and Wake Island and Guam, and the Gilberts and the Marshalls and the Solomons, and on down to New Guinea at Lae and Buna and Gona, and looking down the throat of the Australian and American forces at the Australian bases where the United States had a very important foothold. And then gradually the island-hopping technique in America's arsenals began pouring out the tanks and the guns and the planes and the ships. As a boy, I remember so well because the city of Vanport, which was later on pretty much obliterated by a flood, but up near Portland, Oregon, almost overnight, a mushroom-like city sprang up where the Kaiser shipyards were building these jeep carriers and also the Liberty ships. At the height of our war production, we were building 365 of those ships a year in that one shipyard. Kaiser was actually launching a ship a day. The tens of thousands of pieces of equipment that we manufactured, the trucks and jeeps and tanks and armored personnel and troop carriers, it's just unbelievable when you look back at what happened during World War II to plummet the United States into number one in all the world. But we weren't willing to stay number one. Now today we have suffered a series of dramatic reversals. American presence will be threatened. Virtually there is no presence to speak of anyway of any real consequence in the Indian Ocean. Oh, we have had units of the 7th Fleet, primarily assigned to the Japanese area and around Korea, but they have stood offshore Vietnam. But the Indian Ocean is going to become a Russian lake very soon. The United States 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean is already outclassed and to some degrees at least strategically outnumbered by the Soviet Union. Now we find the flank and the underbelly of Europe and NATO is wide open to the Soviet Union. We find that Portugal is being taken over now by a leftist-type dictatorship, and apparently American bases will be invited out. Turkey and Greece both miffed equally with the same charges against the United States because of the Turkish and Greek Cypriot War appeared to be about to invite United States forces out. The huge air bases we have built to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars inside Turkey will for all practical purposes be lost, just as were those in North Africa in earlier days when the United States was invited out. So we are losing bases while the Soviet Union is gaining bases in these same areas. When I fly across the Atlantic, which I intend doing in only a few days now, usually in the springtime of the year, the winds being what they are, well, most of the year, it just seems there's almost a permanent low hanging over Iceland. And so the winds, the way they are in the North and Central Atlantic, pretty much always decide for us that we go the southern route, and we'll jump off out of St. John's, Newfoundland, or Gander, or Goose, or somewhere up there, usually either Gander or St. John's. We'll get down to the Azores. And the place we land in the Azores Island is Santa Maria. But up north of there, the very large American Air Force and Navy base at Lages, or Lages, L-A-J-E-S,
That's the base you'll be reading about in the news here a great deal, because we're about to lose it. With this leftist dictatorship, it's very likely the United States will be invited out of that very important base out in the middle of the Atlantic for American Air Force planes and ASW patrols and the like. And you'll probably be reading about that. So here again, the western flank of Europe is finding an intrusion by the Soviet Union. Soviet ships will be visiting Lisbon and Portuguese ports, Oporto and Lisbon, no doubt. Soviet sailors strolling up and down the streets of Lisbon. I expect very much the next time I go to Lisbon to see precisely that. So the United States is losing out in the Indian Ocean, in Southeast Asia. It's losing out in the Mediterranean. It's losing out even in the Atlantic. NATO is beginning to fragment. And you begin to wonder, well, where do we go from here? Will we pull back into a completely isolationist posture? No doubt these are going to be great issues in the coming presidential elections. U.S. foreign policy is going to be foremost in a lot of people's minds. The domestic issues are going to be very large. The issues of growing crime, the issue, no doubt, of unemployment and the economy, of stagflation, as it's being called, these will loom very large in any presidential election. And whether or not the present administration can turn it around, whether it will bottom out and start back up, is going to be very crucial to whether or not the Republicans could even hope to make any gains or keep a man in the White House in 1976. I think I better not comment about what most of the American public thinks about that, because I don't have any current opinion polls. But you have to look at the present overview and wonder if we are not seeing a bizarre repetition of history. Will we, in practical fact, begin to pull back, withdraw, see a diminution of strength, and a diminution of interest in other countries abroad, and then finally some gigantic traumatic attack which will finally awaken the United States to the immediacy of one more great world war? But will that awakening come too late? Do you know that Bible prophecy has a great deal to say about it? Do you know that we are identified in the pages of the Bible? Do you know that the United States and a British Commonwealth of people can be identified in the pages of biblical prophecy? And do you know that our future is foretold? That we are given one warning after another about our national way of life? What is a political football, an issue which might cause a president to either be ousted from office or propel or another one into office, is in fact covered in the Bible as a dramatic warning against a people who are drifting into every kind of incredible lawlessness, licentiousness, immorality, the breakup of home and family, the mounting of crime where white-collar crime make normal thieves look like pikers, how employee thefts account for huge business losses, the chicanery, graft, and corruption in government, one trial after another of leading governmental figures accused of taking bribes. A vice president has to resign in ignominy, almost called a common criminal. A president is ousted out of the White House. The agony of Watergate that goes on year after year after tiresome, traumatic year. A president is put in office who was the choice of the vice president of a former president who was forced to resign. A Democratic Congress, very balky, uncooperative, resisting almost everything the current president tries to do. At the very time when the United States ought to be leading the world in strength of character, in strong moral purpose, in believing in its rightness, a total dedication in belief of the spirit of 76, of all of our principles of freedom, the precious freedoms we enjoy, our entire system of free enterprise and a capitalistic system of competition, at a time when we should be so staunch, so absolutely rooted in the basic beliefs of our people, it seems we are fragmenting, fighting among ourselves, wondering what America is all about, not even sure where we should stand in the world community of nations, not sure what our commitments should be. It is very doubtful right now, today, believe it or not, that should a concerted attack from all of the Arab neighbors of Israel knife into Israeli territory, bring about the same kind of a debacle there that you right now are reading about in Vietnam, it is very doubtful whether or not the United States would be willing to commit troops, or direct military aid into that struggle. Now, in the past, we've always committed military aid. We have not been asked for any troop commitments. Israel has been accused for not leaning upon the United States enough. But that seems to be our mood today. If communist armies should suddenly launch an attack once again into South Korea, would we respond? We have people garrisoned there. If an attack should come from a communist Eastern European satellite across into Europe, would we respond? We have troops garrisoned there. If another violent overthrow of government with a communist in charge should occur elsewhere where the United States has vast and important interests in Southeast Asia, the Philippines, perhaps, would the United States respond? Those are questions I'm not sure any American knows how to answer right now, because the people are so jaded, so disillusioned, so frustrated over the incredible lessons we didn't learn in Korea and Vietnam. I think everyone knows what a totally unpopular decision it would have to be for any president in office in the White House to commit U.S. troops in our new all-volunteer, new-look army into some additional military confrontation abroad. Well, we are indicted time after time after time in the Bible for our lack of moral strength, purpose, and character. We're indicted for being a nation of lawbreakers, a nation of juvenile delinquents, a nation of criminals. Oh, we like to say it's the other guy. We like to say it's the fellow lurking around the bushes behind the schoolyard who was selling dope to our nice little kid. We like to say that the criminal is the exception among us, yet time and time when you look at the profile of a criminal and you find his entire psychological makeup, he looks like Mr. Average USA. And it is this crisis of morality and the crisis of the spirit in the United States that is the biggest crisis of all we really face. It has to do with the simple equation of sin versus righteousness. It has to do with the simple question of right versus wrong. And we increasingly seem to be unable to decide between the two. God's Word says any people who would obey His law would walk the high places of the earth, would reap every great reward and benefit you can begin to imagine. Those statements are given over and over again in the Bible, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy, the 28th chapter that I've quoted from so often on this program, enumerate exactly that series of curses and blessings, if you like to call them that. In Leviticus 26, he says, if you walk in my statutes, and people don't really know even what are the statutes of God. Now, you and your local community have what are called statutes, civil codes. There are books in law libraries, in the county courthouse, that enumerate all the various laws by which your life is regulated, whether it has to do with parking meters or cattle guards. And God gave ancient Israel statutes and judgments and commandments. Commandments are the Ten Commandments. Statutes are other laws regulating commerce, marriage, religion, industry, education, based upon the broad principle of the Ten Commandments, and judgments are just what they are today. Verbal, oral decisions rendered upon different cases based upon those commandments and those statutes. He said, if you walk in my statutes, the laws that he gave, and keep my commandments and do them, then I will give you rain in due season. Now, we don't get rain in due season, gently, softly, just exactly in the measurable amounts we need, when we need it. No, instead we get giant deluges and floods and outpourings and cloudbursts. And right now, people all along certain of the southern reaches of the Mississippi rivers that dump into that are experiencing horrible flooding. And that before that incredible amount of extra heavy snowfall and late spring storms came sweeping across the northern midsection of the United States and the New England states, but principally all of those millions of tons that were dumped on some of the states across our wheat belt, which are going to melt and are going to come roaring down the Mississippi River. I understand they're even having emergency talks in some of the city councils and some of the big cities along the Mississippi because they know they can expect some incredible runoff this year from that kind of storm. And here God's Word says if we were obeying His laws, which we are not, we would have the rain in due season. The land would yield her increase. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall reach unto the vintage and the vintage unto the sowing time. It says the guy with the harvesting equipment would have to hurry to get out of the way with the fellow with the plow who follows along behind. But instead, we had, even because we had put additional millions of acres into production that had been in soil bank and kept out under government subsidy last year, we still barely broke even, but had a lower yield by far than was really expected. This year it could get a lot worse. God said, I will give you peace in the land, that's if you keep the law, and you will lie down and none make you afraid. But what is the way of life today? People don't lie down at night unafraid. The stories that you hear in your newspapers every single day, if you live in a big city, the fear of crime that has literally altered our architecture, that has caused people to begin living in the back of the home, that has caused people to begin putting up high-rise apartments that are very hard to get in and out of. It causes you to carry, if you live in one of those, 3, 4, or 5 separate keys. One to get in your garage, one to get in the elevator, one to enter your own floor, one to enter your own door. And then you got to have all these safety devices, peepholes, double locks, or triple locks. You got to lock your French windows and doors, cut the shrubbery around places where crooks might hide. You hear the stories of little old ladies knocked to the ground, their purses snatched, and they're scared half to death to even walk the streets in broad daylight. And in spite of that enormous amount of increase in crime, law-breaking, total disregard for the lives of other people and their property, we have white-collar crime that's costing America billions of dollars more per year than all violent street crime put together. Now, most of the public attention is given to high-level official corruption. And yet, an ongoing problem of billions of dollars proportion is stock frauds, white-collar crime, embezzlement, stealing on the job, robbing the boss, the clerks, the managerial personnel, who are taking money and goods at such a rate that it's an unbelievable cost, as high as $50 billion a year in the United States. The offenses loosely grouped in this white-collar category account for about 4/5 of that $50 billion a year. Law enforcement officers know that. Now, let me define white-collar crime here first. White-collar crime is basically bribery, stock theft and manipulation, kickbacks, pilferage out of the till, tax evasion, fraud, embezzlement, I think I said, various computer-related schemes, land development, real estate, insurance schemes, all kinds of frauds included in that, a great deal in land development today because people want security, they want to buy a little piece of property somewhere, and so the schemes that you see of selling worthless swamp land or worthless desert land. They have the beautiful ads about your little A-frame in the wilderness you're going to retire to. When you get there, you see something so burnt it isn't fit for a Gila monster or a jackrabbit. Tens of thousands of Americans get taken every year on that type of thing. That's white-collar crime. And the FBI said there's been a 30% increase in convictions for white-collar crime since mid-1972. And the cost of white-collar crime, according to police statistics, dwarfs that of street crime. However, the FBI's own uniform crime reports are indicative of how white-collar crime has been ignored. We don't like to be told we are virtually a nation of criminals, that you can't trust a TV repairman. I don't mean the one who's going to write me the letter to say, hey, Armstrong, you think I'm honest. Maybe he is, and maybe I'm going to get a letter. But I'm saying that you don't know who is who. And when something goes on the blink, especially if you're a lady, you live at home alone, you got a TV set, that's your whole window to the world, that's your main source of entertainment and comfort and so on, the minute you get into that lonely living room, you turn it on. Something goes on the blink, you don't know what in the world it is, you look in the yellow pages and call a TV repairman. He says, well, I got to take down to the shop. He comes back, the bill's only $350. You say, my, what in the world was all about? As well as the transistor, and then there was a transducer, and a little bit of the tube, and the beam ahator. The coagulator was going wrong behind the thingamabob. Besides that, the doohickey had become cross-wired with the doover. And by the time I fixed the doohickey was broken. You know, and by the time he's through with all the language, which neither you nor he really understands, why, you just kind of go away shaking your head and wonder how in the world you're going to pay the bill. Or he comes because your dryer and your washer is broken down. He takes that out and says, well, he had to put in this and that and the other. The motor was burned out, had to put in a whole new part, and had just about replaced. The only thing you've got back, really, is the outer shell, according to him. The whole guts of the thing were replaced. Or the automobile. You take it into a garage. I mean, don't take it in, just say, hey, I hear a noise in there, hope you'll fix it. You may as well buy a new car, jack up the radiator cap there and drive a new one under it for all they're going to charge you by the time they get through, all things are going to do. and labor. When you find out what that guy... Now, when you were there watching him work on somebody else's car, looked to you like he's moving pretty slow, right? But boy, by the time you get socked for labor... I mean, there are crimes, and then there are crimes. When you start talking about crime, why don't you start talking about the thing that nettles and bugs and bothers and annoys everybody? Like wretched, shoddy, slipshod service. Is it any wonder they say there are millions upon millions of foreigners inside the United States who are here illegally? I'll tell you why. Because most Americans aren't willing to take a servant-type job. Americans don't want to be hotel servants, waiters, busboys, clerks. No, they just don't want to be. They don't want to be drivers and errand runners and enjoy, you know, that kind of a job of waiting on some other human being. No, that's why you go to a restaurant anymore. You can barely understand the guy. I mean, you go into a pretty good high-class restaurant, and there is a mixture of five or six or seven foreign races. I mean it sincerely. They claim there are so many illegal immigrants inside the United States because of our loathing for hard work and middle and to low wages that if all of them were exported, or deported rather, that our entire unemployment picture would be over. That's what they claim. There are just about exactly the same number of illegal immigrants inside the United States as there are jobs which aren't available. So if you just got rid of the one, apparently all of our joblessness would be over. It's really remarkable. And it's all a part of our whole approach toward life. People just do not want to give an honest day's work for an honest day's wage. Thrift, honesty, integrity, justice, equality, these are just empty words to people. So the next time you think about getting your car repaired or your TV set repaired or your washer or dryer repaired, or the next time you go to the sale where everything's marked down, the next time you go to have something worked on, or you go to the restaurant and you want good service, or you board the bus or the airplane and you wonder why the stewardess seems to be so busy with everybody else except you, well, just think about it. Oh, they can make it look good in the TV ads. But I mean just the cost that we are charging each other because of our unbelievable desire for making money in a hurry. Well, it's all labeled in the Bible, and we are called a nation full of crime. And I'll have to break off for lack of time and just barely getting into the subject, but you can write for a brand new book that we've got called Crime Can Be Stopped, Here's How. That shows you exactly what is the curse of crime, the cause of it, and the cure for crime, shows you how bad it is. And the current number of The Plain Truth with this article on Indochina's agony and why the Middle East talks collapsed. The Plain Truth and this booklet, Crime Can Be Stopped, will get it in the mail to you as quickly as we receive your letter. There's never any bill to follow. We would like to know the call letters of the station to which you're listening, the name of this radio station, and then we'll get your Plain Truth in the mail as quickly as we can. If you send your letter to Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales.